The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So Dave, in our first story, we are getting a little bit closer to some primates.
Right. You know, for a long time, researchers have said that the closest living relative we have on Earth is the chimpanzee, because chimps share 99% of their DNA, or almost 99% of their DNA with us, which does make them our closest living relative. But according to a new study, chimps now have some competition from bonobos, which have had their genome sequenced for the very first time. And it turns out bonobos are just as close to us genetically as chimpanzees are.
So just how close is this DNA to our own?
Well, bonobos share 98.7% of their DNA with us, which is pretty much the same amount that chimpanzees share with us. But what's interesting about this 98.7% is that bonobos and chimps aren't sharing exactly the same genes with us, even though overall the percentage is the same. It turns out that we share about 1.6% of our DNA with chimps that we don't share with bonobos, and we share 1.6% of our DNA with bonobos that we don't share with chimpanzees. Researchers aren't really clear what these differences entail, but there are some really interesting differences between chimps and bonobos. Bonobos tend to be a lot more social than chimpanzees, and when scientists have looked at similarities in behavior, it actually seems like we share a lot more similarities in behavior with bonobos than with chimpanzees. So it's possible that some of these differences in gene sharing could explain those differences.
So what does this tell us about the common ancestor that we all share?
Well, evolution tells us that the common ancestor of bonobos, chimps, and humans gave rise to all of us about 5 to 7 million years ago, and that chimpanzees and bonobos diverged from each other about 1 million years ago. And the fact that we seem to have sort of pieces of chimp and pieces of bonobo in us suggests if this ancestral population that gave rise to all of us was very diverse. The researchers actually calculated it had about 27,000 breeding individuals in it. I'm not sure how they got that number, but that's really interesting to know. And the groups that evolved into bonobos, chimps, and humans also to retain different pieces of this ancestral population, which is why you can have these three species that are very closely related but aren't necessarily sharing all of the same genes in common.
So I suppose the study of bonobos is now going to play a much bigger role in learning about human history.
Exactly. You know, a lot of scientists had said that we really should ignore bonobos when we think about human evolution, which is because we know so much about chimps and chimps seem so highly related to us. Now that bonobos are in the same pool, researchers are saying we really need to pay a lot more attention to them when we're thinking about where we came from.
All right. And this leads nicely into our next story, which is also about genetics, the genetics of aging.
Right. And Carrie, this story isn't just about genetics. It's about something called epigenetics. And epigenetics involves modifications that are made to DNA. There's something called chemical methyl groups, which can attach to pieces of DNA. And they kind of act like a mute switch often, which means that they sort of turn down the volume of a gene. So if you've got a gene that maybe protects you against cancer and you get it methylated, and perhaps you might not be as good at battling cancer as you were before. That's just a hypothetical. Everybody seems to have different patterns of methylation and different genes sort of being turned off and turned on by these chemical modifications. And the question is this something that changes over our lifetime? Do our methylation patterns change as we get older?
So how could we figure out whether or not there's a correlation between methylation and age?
Well, these researchers took a fairly simple approach to that problem. They said, well, let's look at the methylation patterns of a newborn baby and compare it to the methylation patterns of centenarians. These are people that are 100 years old or older. And they looked at a man who was actually 103 years old. And really interestingly, they found that the baby had a significantly higher level of methylation in his DNA than the old man did, which does suggest that, at least based on these two individuals, that methylation seems to decrease over time.
Now, how do we even detect DNA methylation in the first place?
Well, that's a great question. The researchers use a test they call the WGBS test. What they basically do is they extract white blood cells and they add a chemical called sodium bisulfate. And this turns the methylated DNA into another chemical which can be detected. And the researchers sort of create a map based on all of this data.
And so what does this tell us about disease? As you gave an example earlier about cancer, could this help us at all understand the basis of age-related disease?
Well, you know, what was really interesting was, you know, besides finding out that this old man had a lot less methylation than the baby did, it turns out this methylation was absent in genes that were important for disease. So, for example, the centenarian, the old man, had a loss of methyl groups on genes that increase the risk of cancer. And remember how I said that methyl groups often sort of act as a mute switch. So if you've got this gene that could potentially cause cancer and then you have a mute switch on it, well, then it's okay because you're sort of taking that gene out of the equation. But all of a sudden, if you get older, the methylation disappears and you've got this active gene that's going to potentially cause cancer, then your chances of developing cancer could be increased. And that could explain why, as we get older, diseases like cancer and diabetes tend to increase.
And our last story tells us that even wild animals don't always finish their dinner.
Right. This isn't just a problem of people in Western countries. This is a study that has to do with a large cat named the puma, although you may know it by many of its other names like panther or mountain lion or cougar. And what's amazing about the puma is it has this super wide range. Pumas are found everywhere from southeastern Alaska to almost the southern tip of South America. So there's really wide ranges. But we don't actually know a lot about puma behavior, despite the fact that they exist in so many places. So what researchers did over the past couple of years is they caught some pumas living in southern Chile and they strapped GPS radio collars on them. And this allowed them to track pretty much everywhere the pumas went. And then they found places where the puma has had just made a kill and wandered off. And they looked at the carcasses. They actually looked at about 433 puma-killed carcasses, not puma carcasses. The pumas they studied, which was in a region about six times the size of the District of Columbia, had abandoned more than 2.5 metric tons of meat every month. So they're really leaving a lot of leftovers when they make a kill.
So can we have something to compare this to? What do some other animals leave behind?
Well, wolves, which researchers have studied in Yellowstone, leave behind about 85 to 156 kilograms of meat for every 100 square kilometers of their range. And just to compare to pumas, that's about one-third to two-thirds of what's left by pumas. So wolves aren't nearly as generous in their leftovers as pumas are.
So what happens to these leftovers?
Well, that's a really interesting part of the story. These leftovers actually seem to play a really important role in the ecosystem. The researchers didn't just find the carcasses. They found a lot of animals eating on the carcasses, especially a lot of bird species, a couple of mammal species, and even a lizard, although I think the lizard was actually maybe eating insects that had been attracted to the carcass. But one of the birds that was attracted to the carcass and was eating the meat was the rare Andean condor, which is a threatened species. And so the suggestion is that a lot of these species, especially a lot of these species that might be sort of on the brink of going extinct, are really dependent on this meat that's left over by these big cats.
So there really are a lot of indirect effects of the puma on the ecosystem than simply predator-prey relationships.
Right. It's not just that the puma are killing species, which actually can be good for certain species. The deer, for example, they can sort of grow out of control and start starving if there's not a predator to keep them in check. But it's not just that, which we'd already sort of suspected. It's this sort of thing that we didn't really think about too much before, which is how many scraps they're leaving after they take down prey.
All right. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, we've got a story about rabies and vampire bats. Everybody loves vampires. So, of course, we have to do a story about it. Also, a story about why eunuch spiders are better fighters. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a new effort by politicians to basically legislate out the impacts of climate change, to sort of deny climate change by passing bills that would sort of not take any account of future global warming into future policy decisions. Also, for Insider, we've got a story about a new open access journal with a very unusual pay model. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the science of fatherhood, how paternal behavior varies from species to species. And next week, our chat is about the science of organ donation. What are researchers learning about why our body rejects organs, and what is the future of organ transplantation? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.